Group's summer school at the cynical Greyshot, Thursday afternoon, 9th April 1981. Now, two good people have submitted some very good questions, and here I see another lot of questions. Do you agree that letting go of all negativity is an essential prerequisite to spiritual growth? I do not know whether what was in the questioner's mind when he used the word negativity. We have to remember always that we as we are, psychophysical organisms, are negative as well as positive, both physically and psychically. Each of those aspects has its part to play in our everyday life, because in our everyday life we are constantly receiving impressions and we are responding to them. Depending upon the impressions received, the response will be either positive or negative, as the case may be. So that the qualities which are associated with positivity and negativity, both physically and psychically, have to be present in us, you see. And those, they have to be developed. We ourselves, each one of us, is either predominantly positive or predominantly negative. It depends upon the constitution of the person. You know how the psychophysical organism comes into being. The fetus grows into a male or a female, ultimately. Mind, in its totality, interacting with materiality, the body, produces the psyche as such. The psyche is specific to each one of us. Mind is universal, it is characterless. You cannot ascribe qualities to mind. It is the archetypal form of the primordial creative energy, which in action in eternity gives rise to a cosmos as such. And we as integral parts and parcels of the cosmos, experiencing the impact of this energy upon us, express that impact or let that impact function in terms of our psyche as such, which is specific to us. Now, why is it specific to us? Because it is rooted, the psyche as such is rooted in the brain and nervous system, in the activity of the ductus glands and so forth, in the body as specifically. And since every single body is absolutely unique, this impress of the characterless universal energy gives rise to the specific, limited, individual psyche, which has characteristics. You see how the fetus comes into being. It is the result of a gamete from the mother's body intermingling with a gamete from the father's body to produce a zygote which develops into the individual as such. Now the gamete in the male and the female is formed as a result of the reorganization of all the hereditary qualities which each person has inherited from his or her parents. So, when the zygote is formed, and out of that zygote, the new individual, he is absolutely new. The number of permutations and combinations is literally infinite. The possibility is countless. There are countless possibilities. So that any one individual, even in the case of identical twins, there is nobody like him whatsoever in the world now, or there was no individual in the past like him, and there never will be another individual just exactly like him. Therefore, when this characterless universal energy, which we call mind, which is really the proper way to look at mind, at least that is, as far as I'm aware, the Buddha's own teaching and presentation of the nature of mind as such. The Buddha apparently never used the word psyche. No one has used the word psyche until the Greeks invented that word. And no one since the time of the Greeks has presented psyche and mind in this way. I think it's a helpful way of understanding the whole situation. We say my mind, when strictly speaking, we ought to say my psyche. Psyche is mine. Mind is not mine. What we commonly call my mind is just a collection of mental constructs which are impediments to the light of transcendence and to the realization of transcendence. We have to get free of all these mental constructs, which, of course, are blockages in the psyche as such. So now, letting go of all negative is an essential prerequisite to spiritual growth, is it? I should hardly think so. I think both the negative and the positive aspects of our constitution should be utilized in the right way. This is what we have to learn individually. No one can teach us that, simply because we are utterly unique. Each one of us is utterly unique. We can take hints from other people. We can derive inspiration from other people and so forth. And sometimes, if we are fortunate enough for the contact to be to give rise to the right sort of stimulus, the result is very fruitful indeed for our own growth, psychologically as well as spiritually. Because whatsoever touches the psyche and purifies the psyche, and that is one of the meanings of what is religion, anything that purifies the psyche and the whole psychophysical organism, if that happens, then we are very fortunate if that sort of stimulus can take place. And it all conduces to spiritual growth, which, do remember, essentially means the transformation of our mode of awareness of existence, of the totality. That is what spiritual growth really means. And the religious life conduces to that, for the simple reason that the truly religious life is in harmony with the universal process of development, the developmental process. Of course, religion touches us specifically as human beings, because we constitute the human species of the animal world. Now, further, does there have to be a catalyst? Well, everything in the universe is a catalyst. Any person you meet, any experience you go through, anything that you perceive through your own senses, all that is a catalyst, provided you are awake to the thing. That is the important part. Our power of attentiveness is our instrument of salvation. You see? That is what it is. And everything can act as a catalyst if we let it. Sometimes the catalyst is extremely powerful. We can't help that. It may be due to affinity with another person, or a set of ideas which are presented in a philosophy or religious teaching or whatever it may be. And they all act as catalysts. That is one of the reasons why Krishnamurti emphasizes so much, see, see clearly, observe, listen. We don't see and listen in the complete and perfect way. If you look deeply enough into the Buddha's teachings, you will find how he stresses the importance of complete and full observation. Then that brings about clear consciousness, as he calls it, which is of the utmost importance. So, does there have to be a catalyst? Well, of course. Everything is a catalyst in any case, if we let it be so. But I think we have to beware of not exercising preferential choice for a particular kind of catalyst, because that can easily land us into difficulties in so many ways, especially in terms of our relationships with other people and the right expression of that relationship which is formed. Now, further, should this commence at the physical level, removing energy blockage first, otherwise spirituality is mere aspiration. Aspiration is just aspiration. It can be directed towards, it can be an aspiration towards that which is spiritual or conduces to spirituality. But spirituality itself is never mere aspiration. Aspiration is the outgoing of the whole of the self towards that to which you aspire. And this is important. It is important to remember this. You may aspire to become a tycoon, or you may aspire to become president of some place or other, or some society or whatever it is. Or you may aspire to be the greatest rogue in the world, which aspiration sometimes is fairly easily fulfilled if you have the ability to do so. So spirituality as such is never mere aspiration or pure aspiration. Aspiration is a psychical phenomenon. Now, should this commence at the physical level, removing energy blockage, be very careful of all that. Don't separate out the levels. We are a spiritual and organic whole. And if we separate out the spiritual aspect, the psychological aspect, the intellectual and emotional aspect, and the physical aspect, then we are fragmenting ourselves quite unnecessarily, which only makes for greater trouble in the long run. So don't say, I will deal with the physical level first and the other level afterwards. Let our own body be our teacher here. The heart doesn't function from 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. and then hand over to the kidneys from 8 to 10 and then hand over to the lungs from 10 to 12 and so on. I'll be dead if I tried to do that. And serve me right for it, for such folly. So don't separate out things. A blockage is an energy blockage is a blockage at every level simultaneously. Do try and realize the simultaneity of everything that concerns not only our individual life, but the total life of the universe. We constantly use this word universe with not the slightest sensitivity to the fact that it is universal. The moment we try to fragment it, there is misery, there is illness, disease, decay, and death. So, treat treat oneself and treat everybody else, and in fact the whole world, as a unitary whole. Bear in mind everything. This is what makes for the difficulty. We have little capacity for true attention. But if there is true attention, you will be aware in terms of wholeness. You won't be aware in terms of the whole, in the sense that you are conscious of every separate object and person and event and so forth. Not that way. But the sense of wholeness will pervade your entire psychophysical constitution, and therefore that spirit of holiness will be at work removing any energy blockage. And also, don't think in terms of removing an energy blockage. Utilize it. Convert it. If energy is acting as a block, all right, look into it intensely, carefully, free of any preconceptions of what it ought to be, and thereby you will convert that energy which is blocking into energy that is constructive and bringing you to fruition. Wholeness, all the time. As Zarathustra said, haurvatat. The perfect health, the wholeness, the holiness. Now the next question. Must we all fully experience the lower chakras, the world of commerce, worldliness, sex, before aspiring to opening the heart and higher chakras? Must we all fully experience the lower chakras? We do all experience the lower chakras, willy-nilly. And that's that. You might say, I'm a celibate, I abstain from sex. But no one is a celibate until he is the perfected holy one. No one is a celibate because, if not in physical non-celibacy, there is always the psychological lack of celibacy. There are fantasies in people's minds. There are feelings, emotions, outgoings towards other people in terms of sexual relationship. If a person, for example, gives a first-class lecture like I do, and you see, or gives a marvelous performance on the concert platform or something, that's an act of sexuality. Has it ever struck you that all psychophysical manifestation involves sexuality? The positive, the negative, the male, the female. It is always there. What makes the difference between a pure sexuality and an impure sexuality is that the pure sexuality is devoid of concupiscence. This comes out in Zarathustrian teachings in a remarkable way. It's devoid of concupiscence. The desire that draws whatsoever is the object of desire to oneself in a separative, isolative manner. Then that is impure sexuality. Otherwise the element of sexuality is constantly at play. Good manners towards one another is sexuality. It's a courtship. Is it not? And we always say, oh, isn't that a very nice girl? Or isn't that man an awfully nice man? This is sexuality at play. And sexuality in itself can be just perfect and pure. And without sexuality, we would never have had the great spiritual teachers of the world born even. So, Must we all fully experience the lower chakras? Well, we do experience the lower chakras constantly, but not necessarily fully. In actual fact, not fully. And it is not necessary to experience all these things fully in the quantitative sense. If we experience them in the qualitative sense and extract the essence of our experience out of it, it is tantamount to experiencing it fully. Because all these experiences, all that we call the lower, is ultimately transcended by us. Now do remember, transcending means not getting rid of or being free of it in the wrong sense. Transcending means that we have so fully understood and utilized commerce, worldliness, sex and so forth, that everything has become transformed into something rich and strange, something which we don't know, which we cannot visualize through our imagination only. And then that conduces to the opening of the heart and higher chakras. It conduces towards it. When the higher chakras, as we call them, the Vishuddhi, which deals with prophetic speech, remember, not with ordinary speech, worldly speech, it deals with prophetic speech. When Vishuddhi and Ajna awaken, where the voice of the Master is heard constantly, and that voice of the Master which is heard constantly is from within the inner depths of your own consciousness. That's where the voice comes from. It's the soundless voice, the unheard voice in the usual way, but it is something which is yours in a sense similar to the sense in which we talk of the third eye within man, and that deals with the Ajna chakra. Clear seeing, clear consciousness, as the Buddha said. You know how Jesus put it. He said, I tell you these things because my Father told them to me. Had not my Father in heaven told them to me, I could not tell you these things. So you see, the higher chakras open up naturally that way. Don't seek the opening of higher chakras and so forth, because there is in actual fact nothing which is higher, nothing which is lower. All these comparisons are man-made comparisons, and they have very little value. See what is true, what is good, what is beautiful, and that which is less than that, of course that is a comparative word, sorry, that which is not quite up to that will naturally fall away from you. You don't have to overcome evil, you don't have to fight against the evil things, because you strengthen the evil things thereby. It's like, you know, two boys wrestling with each other, and they know that they are wrestling with each other in order to get stronger and stronger. That is their real objective, and they do make each other stronger by the exercise of wrestling, by any exercise which involves a certain amount of friendly competition and so forth. So if you try to fight against evil and get rid of it, you will only make it worse. Understand it fully. Understand it completely. Understand it means not analytically, not just analytically, taking it to bits. That's the activity especially of the left side of the brain. And that is the side of the brain which is confined to the psychophysical level. The right side of the brain deals with the deeper things of consciousness and mind. And it is the right side which is the spiritual heart within man, the right side of the brain. When that right side of the brain functions fully, then you are, and in harmony with the left side, then you are the perfected Holy One. Now, must we all fully experience the lower chakras, etc., before aspiring? No, not before aspiring. If you fully experience the lower chakras in that sort of low-down sense, if I may say so, then you will be nicely stuck in those lower chakras for the rest of your lifetime. You take the man, for example, who gets into the habit of drinking a little too much. Well, what happens? If he goes fully into it and lives fully in those terms, he's done for the rest of his life practically. What will rid him of that is death itself. Don't get caught in the trap of the devil. Once you get caught there is no escape. There is only strangulation. Get really caught. See? The question goes on. If so, how do monks and nuns and others who lead lives of meditation and prayer develop their spirituality? Monks and nuns and others who lead lives of meditation and prayer. We use this word meditation somewhat irresponsibly. True meditation is a meditative state of consciousness. Over consciousness, we have no control whatsoever. None. Our states of mind and feeling, what we call our states of mind, our thoughts and feelings, our words and actions, are the external expressions, that which is pressed out of their source. Their source is consciousness, the thing we don't know. Do remember that. Consciousness in itself, pure consciousness, is the link with the universal, absolute, pure consciousness as such. I will talk about this a little more on Saturday morning. So meditation, the true meditative state, is that state in which consciousness functions in its own transcendent manner, at its own transcendent level. What we commonly call meditation, and all the systems of meditation, are rituals which are mostly verbal rituals and nothing else. They have power, mind you. They have power. For example, in all systems of meditation, emphasis is laid upon the devotional aspect. We visualize the teacher and let our hearts flow out to the teacher. That is excellent from one point of view, because that teacher is the idealized picture we make of the perfect man, the holy man. And because there are thousands of people who do that sort of thing, there is in the psychic atmosphere a power, an energy, which helps us. That is why those who branch out away from the conventional religions of the world find it so difficult to get a hearing at all, because there is nothing in the psychic atmosphere to support them. This is something utterly new. Oh, but our teacher never said that. This cannot be true. Which is, of course, nonsensical. One of the outstanding examples of that, of course, is the Mosaic Law being contradicted by Jesus. The Mosaic Law stating an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, and all that. And Jesus saying, love those who hate you, do good to those who do you harm, and so on. Which was perfectly contradictory to the accepted thing. But what happened in the course of time? The Christian teaching, which is in line with the Buddhist teaching, the Hindu teaching, and the Zarathustrian teaching, which is quite similar, quite similar to the teaching of Jesus, with the exception that Zarathustra does mention fight against evil and the evildoer. Not fight with weapons, but by example and by trying to persuade the evildoer, you see. So there must be no attempt to overcome the evil as such. And meditation, pure meditation, can begin as and when we free ourselves from the necessity to muse. What we call meditation, the dictionary gives the same definition. Meditation is musing. That's the first definition it gives. Then it goes on to say, concentrating attention upon some matter, some important matter or other, especially of a religious nature. That's what is given in Webster's dictionary anyway. You see, that's what's called meditation. But it is not that. Meditation is consciousness functioning at its own transcendent level as such, which we don't know and we cannot know as until we have completely purified the whole of the psyche. And well, how do the monks and nuns develop their spirituality? Well, as I've already suggested, by carrying out the ordinary ritual processes which are called prayer or meditation, the effect of the psychical energy helps the individual to experience a cleaner, purer state, to experience a more elevated, sublime state. And in that way, that person is helped. But do remember, again and again, those who have experienced these sublime states and so forth, they fall quite easily. Particularly if you study the Hindu Puranas, which are full of stories of apsaras, sirens, and such like, alluring the yogi, and the yogi falls just as easily as I could fall. I won't say you, I don't know about you. quite as easily as I could fall, you see. So where are we? All those states are deceptive in this way, that they make us feel, we have now taken the 18th step on the ladder to perfection. There is no ladder to perfection. There are no grades of perfection. Perfection is perfection. There is an absoluteness about it. And perfection belongs to the realm of the infinite, the immortal and the eternal. And there is no measurement possible in that realm. Measurement is possible only in terms of size and quantity. Measurement is not possible in other terms. In terms of quality too, one can say that that person is much kinder than this person and so on, or much stricter than this person and so on. We can say that. But otherwise there is no such thing as measurement in the realm of the spirit. This is one of the fundamental mistakes which has bedeviled the theologies and philosophies of the world. This mixing up of the muddling, and not mixing up so much as muddling the two contexts, of the finite and the mortal with the infinite and the immortal. You'll find it marvelously expressed throughout the whole history of European philosophy. You read any textbook which gives you a good detailed presentation of European philosophy, and you'll see how the great philosophers have fallen down because of this element of comparison and measurement. You can't measure the immeasurable. That's what it amounts to. Now, yes, so how do monks and nuns and others? By their feeling of true devotion and their aspiration towards the truth, they get flashes of insight. And those flashes of insight, if they are of the right nature, contradict their previous ideas and beliefs and perceptions. They thought they perceived the truth through the exercise of reason, logic, and they discover that reason and logic are not the whole thing. There is the irrational, not the irrational. The rational and irrational are both integrated. Note, they are both integrated and transcended. What was the other thing I mentioned? Reason and logic. The logical and the illogical are integrated and transcended. And then one's perception has really penetrated into the realm of truth in itself. You know how in India they say, Satyam nasti paro dharma. There is no religion higher than truth. And that truth is not merely a statement of fact or a description of a particular aspect of the whole universal process. That truth is of such a nature that in the particular as well as in the totality, the truth is seen. The whole truth is embodied in the particular, in the very atom, in the subatomic world too, and that very truth fills the entire universe at the same time. This is the marvel and mystery of the whole creation. We talk of God and the fear of God and awe and trembling, but there is a real awe and a real trembling where the transcendent is concerned. You have to experience it to know it. And you can experience it even in little ways, and that helps. It is that sort of thing which helps the monk, the nun, and others who lead lives of prayer and meditation to develop their spirituality. The spirituality is developed naturally. Don't attempt to develop it. Just as no one can attempt to make the body, after he is born, grow in the way he wants it to grow. I wanted to grow, when I was a little fool, a very little kid, and a very big fool, I wanted to grow much bigger than my father, until my head went through the roof. And my mother used to say, "You idiot, it can never happen that way." Now, another question: does freeing ourselves from our finite being mean that we know no death? Well, would you enlarge on the implication of this state of existence during life and after the death of the body? What value do you ascribe to communication by mediums with specific persons after death? I will answer the last question first. None whatever. I'll start at the beginning. Does freeing ourselves from our finite being mean that we know no death? We free ourselves from finitude, temporality, and mortality in mind and consciousness only. The psychophysical organism as such inevitably dies, and all process of growth implies continuous death of that which is present here and now and that which is the known and the discovered. Consider, for example, an organism growing. The growth of the organism, whether it be a plant or an animal or us human beings, implies that the previous condition undergoes complete change. If it didn't undergo change, there'd be no growth possible. And the same thing applies to our minds, or what we call our minds. So that means that the old has to die, and the old in the dying releases the new. Life and death are really life and other life. Death is, as I put in Thor, God's greatest gift to us. That is what death is. And death must take place immediately, from moment to moment, from split second to split second. And if it can take place in full awareness, at the same speed, so to say, as the actual fact of the which characterizes the living process, then you experience immortality, because you don't know where to draw the line and say this was life and this was death. There is no other immortality whatsoever. Immortality is something which you realize in terms of actual consciousness. When your consciousness is in tune with the pulse of creation itself, which has an incredible speed, when that is the case, the dividing line, which is death, and makes us say, this is life, this is death, this is rebirth, this is re-death, all that vanishes altogether. You are the totality and the infinite. And the infinite is not born and it doesn't die. Because there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade. If there were not that, there'd be no release from bondage to this here that is born, become, and made. This here that is born, become, and made manifests a continuous life-death process simultaneously, a life-other process with incredible rapidity. When your mind and consciousness are so free and so perfected that they thrill in response to this. Something like this. You have the top C of a grand piano, 7.5 octaves. The top C that vibrates at what? 4096 vibrations per second or something. And you take the bottom C, which is 32 vibrations per second. I'm taking the old middle C as 256 because that's a convenient number to take. Now, this bottom C, which has 32 vibrations, is in tune with, in harmony with, that top C with 4096 vibrations. You see, when this happens to us, when our consciousness really thrills and is in tune with the total with the creative pulse of the whole universe, then there is no such thing as death. It's an extraordinary experience altogether. And suddenly you know what immortality means. That is the only immortality that there is. Because all manifested things inevitably decay and pass away, as we say. We say they die, but actually they just change into something which we cannot take hold of that something and return it to its previous condition. But if we could, that would be a most miserably retrogressive step. You see? So don't do it. Would you enlarge on the implication of this state, being free from our finite being? The freedom is in terms of mind and consciousness. Do remember that. It's an extraordinary thing. It's very difficult even to imagine, to conceive what it is like, this freedom. But it is a real thing. It's a fact. The implication of this state of existence, the free state, during life and after death of the body. The implication of the free state during life is that that person is incapable of doing any wrong. You look at the third volume of the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses. There you will find the Buddha stating in no uncertain terms, absolutely categorically stating that the Arahat is incapable of this, this, this and this. He makes 9 such statements. Look at the Digha Nikaya. I have given the reference in 4, in the chapter on the Buddha. So you'll find, you'll know what to look up in the text as such. And after death of the body, after the death of the body, all psychophysical existence, all I am I consciousness is absolutely gone. The personality completely disappears. And that is the thing that all people find very hard to accept. They cling to this ego consciousness, this idea that there is some permanent something inside me. Look at the self-contradictoriness of the statement as such. There is a permanent something inside me. The whole statement is completely self-contradictory. Nothing is permanent. The no thing is the permanent. And the no thing has no manifested existence as such. Nor is it something which belongs to an unmanifested state, as if it was a thing in itself, a separate something. This is, we make these mistakes, and they are very difficult to get rid of, because we are conscious in isolative, self-oriented terms. When we are free of this isolative self-consciousness with respect to human beings and the separative self-consciousness with regard to all objects in the universe, then we shall be free of all these delusions. The question itself is a wrongly worded question, if I may say so. After the death of the body, the whole psyche and everything just disappears. Therefore, these communication by mediums with specific person, they do not communicate with specific persons at all. What the medium gets is an impression. There are impressions in the totality, contained in the totality as such. And as and when the human apparatus, like a radio receiving set, is sensitized in such a manner that it gets the right wavelength, so to say, these impressions in the totality impress themselves upon the brain of the person, and that person says things which may accord with actual facts, but that does not mean at all that there is a dead person talking to you. Do get free of this clinging to the separate ego as a permanent entity. We all do it in some form or other. It's something to go, something which calls for the utmost courage and so forth. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The Lord, Yahweh, I'm using the biblical terms, Yahweh belongs to the context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. You can't parcel out the infinite and say, my immortal soul. It's completely absurd. That creative energy which brought this into being and the total universe into being, that creative energy just remains itself. It's a supreme mystery. I couldn't possibly explain it to you in terms of concepts and words, but if, I can only tell you this, if one really purifies the psyche and frees it from all these clingings, Ananda, freedom from all clinging, from all grasping is deathlessness, said the Buddha. Do remember that. And don't remember the saying merely, but really become conscious of it. And if you really become conscious of it, you will actually experience immortality here and now. your whole life, the whole life of the psychophysical organism will be a life of immortality. That's an extraordinary state. That is why it is so utterly blissful. Ananda, the supreme peace. That is the unoriginated nirvana, as the Buddha put it. And that is the Amritat, as in Zarathustrian teachings. And that is also the sort of teaching you will find throughout the Upanishads, particularly the Yoga Upanishads as such, more so than the so-called principal Upanishads. So this freedom is the freedom from all grasping, all clinging whatsoever. We are always curious about what is going to happen to me after death. Death means the complete end of the me. The complete end, thank goodness. Then there won't be any Firoz Mehta to pester the world in which he lives.